Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance neath the cover of October skies.
You know, the leaves What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz, and we had to drag him out of jury duty, but we got him back, and it's Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. What do you say, Dr. Bob?
Todd, always a pleasure to be on, and glad you got given an excuse to step out.
You know, we got to save you, because, you know, in Chicago, we don't do jury duty. We're a sanctuary city. So Dr. Bob, we got a lot going on, and let's talk about what's going on with Theresa May and what's going over on your side of the ocean.
Well, I mean, I think with Theresa May, I mean, she carries on vacillating. So at the moment, you know, I think it looks like she's again leaning back towards a hard Brexit, but she really doesn't do herself any favors, because, you know, Brexit in itself wasn't the most terrible thing for the UK. It's a far bigger problem for Europe, as you've discussed before. But I think what's really, you know, messed things up all around is Theresa May's unwillingness to actually engage with the country more openly about what her plans are, or indeed what other options might be. And so as a result, what you have is her kind of promising she's going to give some people answers, but never doing it. And so as a result, of course, from the market's point of view, all you have is just uncertainty, uncertainty, and more uncertainty, which ultimately at some point means that regardless of what Brexit might or might not have been, you're actually doing a lot of damage just by not allowing people some visibility on what that future direction is.
So, I mean, when it plays out, my opinion is, I think it's actually better for the Brits myself. That's my opinion. Is that a good opinion or a bad opinion in your opinion?
I always thought it was a much bigger problem for the Europeans than for the Brits. I mean, for the Brits, I mean, you know, is there a benefit to being in Europe? Yes, there is a trading relationship. There is the fact that actually large parts of the economy, such as Scotland, Northern Ireland, etc., do benefit from a lot of the subsidies that Europe effectively brings to these areas. But, you know, Britain by and large, to a large extent, you know, it does not get perhaps as much out of Europe as other countries do. And I think for the Europeans, what's fascinating to me is that, you know, you can really see the politics has overridden common sense. Because, for example, when somebody steps up and says, you know what, I'm unhappy, I want to leave, the sensible thing to do is to say, okay, guys, let's sit down, let's try and work this out, let's figure out what is it that's making you unhappy. Because chances are it's probably what's making a bunch of other people unhappy as well. Instead, what you instead have is now this notion that somehow the British need to pay a divorce penalty of 62 billion euros, I believe, that, you know, the latest country that's taken the presidency of the European Union, Malta, which, as it happens, by the way, has an economy that is dependent hugely on British tourism and financial services, has said that, you know, Britain may need to allow European judges to have supremacy over British law for many years to come, and so on. So I think I see a lot of saber rattling here. I see a lot of people who are kind of standing on their own little totem pole and little ivory tower and thinking, you know, they've got all the answers and actually they've got control. Whereas in reality, that totem pole is swinging pretty wild and looks like it might just topple over.
Well, that's the one thing about no matter where you go, the ivory tower always thinks that they know best and always thinks that they can manipulate things, which I think is probably one of the bigger problems in societies worldwide, is that the ivory tower doesn't have a clue of what's going on outside, and they never, I don't think they ever will. That's my opinion. I just don't see it, Dr. Bob. I don't see these guys getting out and getting their hands dirty, and most of them are career either politicians or career economists that never saw what it was like to get your hands dirty. What do you think?
I agree. In fact, I think even the people who are in charge of, say, Brexit at this side, say Theresa May and her motley crew, are again the same thing, which is career politicians, and not really in touch with, I think, what's happening on the ground floor. And let's not forget, speaking of ivory towers, of course, this week we've got the World Economic Forum kicking off yet again. And I have to say, I found it wonderful that this year in their global risks report, they actually finally got around to talking about populism and, you know, social discontent. One could argue that, you know, the phrases, you know, horse, door, bolted, whoops, kind of come to mind. But having said that, you know, at least they have some inkling of what's going on. But the irony that you then sit around a bunch of meeting rooms and have some wonderful champagne and drink some great meals and talk about how to solve the problems of the world shows you probably haven't actually learned very much.
Well, that we know without saying. So who's next to pull? I mean, is there a next exit coming up? Is there somebody that you see that now wants to potentially try to get out?
No, I don't see an immediate exit, because I think in Europe, the difference between Europe is that you have a lot of countries that I think are unhappy with the direction of Europe, but they don't feel on the outside the way Britain has for a long time. So I think, you know, in the next big sort of flashpoint, as it were, will be the Dutch election, where the Geert Wilders, who is the current leader of the far-right party, looks like he's likely to win. That's not only going to be a huge shock to anyone. I suspect the reaction to markets will be very similar to what happened in the Italian referendum, where because everyone expected Renzi to lose, when he did lose, the market kind of wobbled a bit, but then went straight back to normal. I think the one that people are going to be watching a lot more, of course, is the French election. I don't see Le Pen winning, simply because what traditionally happens is that the one or two times you've actually had, in the case of her father, getting through to the second round, at that point everybody else gangs up, because you only really have two candidates and they all kind of vote for the safe choice. Having said that, I think what people are missing is that it's not so much about which country now votes for exit, it's actually what's happening at these margins. So, for example, when Renzi lost the vote in Italy, the margin of victory for the opposition was supposed to be 3%. It turned out to be more like 20. If you look at the fact that the candidates are standing against Le Pen, and Le Pen, you know, has a very good chance of going to the second round, well, guess what? The center-right candidate isn't Sarkozy. He lost, and in fact, the candidate is somebody who already has said that they are open to having, you know, more friendly relationships with Russia, for example. So already he's starting to break some of the kind of amiable, kind of outward-facing sort of thing that the Europeans do. And similarly, on the socialist side, you've got about seven or eight different candidates, and it's actually not that easy to pick out a clear winner from them. So I can see that whoever ends up being president, while they may not want to leave the Eurozone, all of the people coming into power now gradually are ones that are saying that I don't like the way this is heading for me. I want this to change slightly. And it could be to become more protectionist. It could be that they want to take back more control over their borders and whatever. But I see Europe very, very slowly unraveling. So it's not a kind of classic sort of, right, another country goes, and it all falls apart catastrophically. I mean, that's, I think, the kind of wonderful fiction that people would love to have, because it kind of makes for dramatic headlines. But actually, I think what you have is a far more dangerous erosion of all of the ties that hold these countries together, so that actually one day they all wake up and suddenly realize that while they pay lip service to some European Union, a bit like the Catholic Church, it doesn't actually really hold it together.
And that would be pretty correct. And when we come back from the break, Dr. Bob, I want to know from you, is the Euro going to make it, or is it actually going to collapse? We are with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, one of the smartest guys in the world, and a true economist who really understands what the hell's going on, so I can always respect him from that. Also the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. And, of course, when you miss an episode and you want to hear more of Dr. Bob, you go to libertytalk.fm and download the podcast every single day. And also check out bubbatrading.com, as we are always trying to help and educate you. This is The Bubba Show. I am Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global. The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz will be right back. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. Go to Amazon and buy that book so you can help him out. My man needs a break. Help this economist out, who helps out all the time. Anyway, so Dr. Bob, I don't believe the euro is going to be around in 5 years. Do I have a case? Am I nuts? Or what do you think?
I think there's a good chance the eurozone starts to unravel rapidly. I think it'll last longer than 5 years, but it will be much for pretty sight. I mean, the real critical point, I think, is going to be the German election that comes up later this year. What's interesting is that Merkel has been losing support even within her own party. And interestingly, she has finally started to become a lot more defensive on immigration. You know, she's apparently, there are rumors going around that they're planning now to introduce the fact that refugees can't claim benefits now for a number of years and so on. So I think that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because you can see that's her almost rapidly trying to rescue herself from a potential election debacle come later this year. Because while in Germany there isn't really a clear challenger in the sense that you had in the UK with Brexit or with Donald Trump in the US, but certainly Alternative für Deutschland, which is the populist party in Germany, which to be fair has some pretty unpleasant overtones to it, but that has now dramatically increased the share of the vote to north of 15%, and there's every chance that come the election in Germany, that will have taken 20% of the vote. Now, if that happens, they will have a significant number of seats in parliament. They will still be, of course, a minority, but at the end of the day, they'll have certainly enough of a voice that they will drive a lot of the debate going forward, and they will have a very, very strong platform with which to share their views around. I think the fact that Merkel's own party is very nervous about immigration means that Germany is rapidly less interested in Europe and much more interested in its borders. Now, that's the dangerous bit, because depending on how they react, you can see at some stage Germany starting to think, is this euro problem worth it or not? They've always believed in the strength of their own economy. They believe they've got a fundamentally good economy. Now, at some point, I'm sure the temptation must come that either the eurozone must bend to Germany's will, or if it doesn't, then maybe Germany's better off outside it. So to me, that's the real tail event that no one's planning for, that over the next 2, 3, 4 years, it's not, you know, France or Italy or Spain that decides they want to leave the eurozone. It's actually Germany that decides this thing is just too expensive, too much hassle, and my balance sheet deserves better than this. And they step out. And if that happens, at that stage, the eurozone basically is another emerging market, Brazilian real. It's a basket case economy at that stage.
Well, I mean, isn't that Germany is the main driver. They were one time the most successful, but I think they're failing very badly now. But I mean, was it better in your opinion? Now the euro's been around what, for about 14 years or something like that? Is that about right?
20.
Okay. So are you of the opinion that it was a good thing that they did it 20 years ago, or was it a bad thing that they did it? What's your general opinion of the eurozone?
I think it was a bad experiment. And I think the reason being is that while I understand the kind of whole drive they had for fiscal or monetary union, they should have first tried to get some sort of political union first. You know, the fundamental problem with the currency is much more than just a medium of exchange. You know, at the end of the day, if it was just as simple as that, we'd all be running around with trading cards and stuff. What a currency actually implies also is a whole set of bonds among societies. So, you know, I think if I look at the UK with Scotland and the rest of Britain, Scotland, by and large, has always had enormous subsidies flowing to it from the rest of the UK, because in general, they have actually the larger part of the population employed by the state, not by the private sector, and they have enormous subsidies that go in them. If you go into the US, you will similarly see at any given moment, there are states that are doing very well, states that are doing very poorly. Historically, for example, a state like Mississippi would have typically been the recipient of lots of federal payments that have been effectively bailouts, internal bailouts, helping that economy kind of struggle along. Now, the fact of the matter is, in the UK and the US, no one really complains about that. I mean, you might get some people griping about, you know, the welfare payments are too high, or that, you know, my tax dollars shouldn't have to go to this extent. But no one really complains in a big way. In Europe, there is no camaraderie of that sort. The Germans are a different country and a different, entirely sort of different sovereign nation to the French, to the Italians, to the Spanish, to the Greek. So the idea that somehow you guys were all going to bail each other out, which is the implication, by the way, of having this common currency, well, that was always false from the start. So the problem in the good times, yeah, guys, we've got the same currency, and it's wonderful, we can all go into those countries and shop like crazy, and I can borrow money in your currency, and you can lend me lots of money in my currency. That works wonderfully. The moment the bad times hit and somebody says, well, great, now we're all in the same boat, we've all got the same currency, guys, let's bail each other out. Everyone says, oh, hang on, I didn't sign up for this spot. And they all want to leave the ship. So you see, the Eurozone, unfortunately, has always been deeply flawed. And I think, in the context of history, by the way, 20 years is not a very long time. And the euro, by the way, could struggle on for another 20 years. And even then, from a historical point of view, it would be a blink of an eye as far as the current system goes.
Now, when I look at the euro, and of course, obviously, that's the euro currency is the main cog in the dollar index of the states. And of course, the euro's been weak, the dollar's been stronger, and obviously 14-year highs now. But when I look at the dollar index, and I know that the euro currency is 60% of the index, it really queers or throws off the actual dollar index and its actual strength because of how it's broken down. Is there a way to fix that, in your opinion?
Well, the Eurozone, I mean, the strength of the Eurozone, the weakness of the Euro versus the dollar, reflects partly the relative performances right in the Euro bloc as a whole and the U.S. economy. I don't know if it necessarily is throwing the basket that much off, because, you know, the U.S. by and large, in terms of the dollar, if you look at where a lot of the U.S. companies with foreign earnings are selling stuff, they are selling it in Europe, in China, and so on. So from that perspective, I guess it's not so different. The challenge, I think, which I find more worrying about the dollar index right now, is that you have a situation where economies are finally beginning to diverge. And the U.S. has started to have some sort of recovery, and I think particularly with the Trump rally, Trumpflation, whatever you want to call this new paradigm, the fact of the matter is sentiment has shifted. And that's meant that people are suddenly a lot more bullish in the U.S. And while that might be a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I do have some doubts there, it does mean that certainly in the near term, you have a lot more buying going on and a lot more selling elsewhere. So the dollar is going to strengthen. The danger is that there is no way the Fed ever was going to raise rates two or three times this coming year. I mean, they may have talked about a three-year rate rise, but that's never really going to happen. On the other hand, this rise in the dollar is actually a form of monetary tightening through the back door, because in effect, although a lot of the economy is domestic, there is still enough of it that's exposed to the outside world that stronger dollar does mean that you are having some tightening of conditions happening behind the scenes as well.
Well, aren't we also having tightening through the Treasury bond market? I mean, the bond markets continue to get cracked, which pushes rates up higher. I mean, so are we are having higher, whether or not the Fed wants to have higher rates, we're getting higher rates no matter what they want to do. And I felt that was going to happen all along. What do you think?
Well, the reality is that we have been going, by the way, through a depression for the last 10 years. But when these things end, they usually end pretty catastrophically. So rates will shoot higher. By the way, I'm probably more in the camp that I think that while they're going to keep going higher for a bit, you will actually see some rallies going back in the other direction. And if you look at the amount of people who are short the Treasury at the moment, it's unbelievably kind of, you know, biased. So that in itself means you've got probably a nice short covering rally set up. But also the other thing is, as I was saying about my point about that being tightening through the back door, the problem you have is that if you suddenly in this environment get one or two missteps by the incoming government, or if you get one or two bits of bad data, everyone then suddenly starts to panic and think, well, maybe we need to rush back into safety. So I think Treasuries probably are not a lot ready to kind of call them dead yet. I think they're a fairly large piece of paper, but there are plenty of people who still see value in
the bull market isn't over yet. Well, we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. This is Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. And of course, this is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. And when you miss an episode, you go to libertytalk.fm. And not only can you get my show there, you can get The Sporting Edge as well as all the other content. We have 24-hour-a-day programming. In the meantime, we're going to stop by here for a break and come back with Dr. Bob after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz, we're coming right back after the break. What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got The Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. So, Dr. Bob, you believe that the Treasury bonds, the futures are going to have a rally and the rates will come down again. And one of your reasons, and I know, is that you believe that the markets are extremely short right now, which would create a massive short covering rally. Is there anything else that would make them actually come back? Is the bull market dead, or is it still in tow?
No, I think it's still got some legs left to it, although it's very, very late in its life now. Let's not forget that the only reason why you've had the most enormous rally in assets across the board, stocks and everything else, has been because of the ultra-low interest rate environment that we've had for the last decade. Now, if you start having rates rise, and markets, by the way, aren't going to kind of let rates rise once or twice. If rates begin to rise, they will start pricing in all sorts of shifts. I mean, I'm seeing already, you know, kind of various strategists talking about how people should think about short-duration bonds, not worry about long-end, do a little about the great rotation happening from bonds to equities and so on. The reality, though, is that if any of this stuff starts to happen, you have some implications which I don't think the markets have fully grasped. For example, very simple one is that if rates start to rise, the cost of servicing debt, including the U.S. government's own debt, starts to rise rapidly as well. You know, that's going to be a break, because that's going to at some point lead to more and more worries about people's ability to pay back. You're also going to have issues around simple things like mortgages. I mean, mortgage rates have already jumped up quite a lot. That is going to feed through, by the way, into a drop in mortgage applications, approvals, and ultimately into housing. You also have the fact that even if you believe all of those can be overcome, because the Fed and others have sucked out so much quality collateral out of the system so that you no longer have a lot of the stuff people would have used in the past, as collateral for interest rate swaps, currency hedges, etc. Well, guess what? Half the stuff that's been there is gone. So most of what's left now is treasuries, T-bills, you know, gilts, and so on. So unfortunately, government bonds in this environment, people just are being forced in some ways to keep holding them. And that's before, by the way, I even mentioned things like the fact that the banks have all these wonderful liquidity rules, etc. I mean, if you're a government right now, yes, you may want rates to rise because somehow that's going to lead you to a road to normality. But I think the problem you have here is that if you're a government right now and if you're a central bank, you look at the rates rising and you think, actually, you don't want them to rise too much too fast, because you're actually deeply worried about how you're going to deal with that sheer quantum of debt you've now built up in terms of all these securities.
Well, you've been about debt every conversation you've ever had, and you also said to me last time we talked, I said that I think that rates are going to go higher, and you said no, because with the things that Trump wants to do, he's not going to let them go higher because they need to get the cheaper money. But cannot the free markets take it over? I mean, here's my thinking, Dr. Bob. I believe that the cheap money didn't help anybody because nobody could get a loan anyways unless you had more collateral. So they weren't going to give you the loan anyway. So what difference does it make if the rates were zero? If you can't get the money, it doesn't matter. Whereas rates, if banks will actually start providing liquidity and lending again, then the average guy on the street who now has to borrow from his credit card or go to a place like Prosper, these peer-to-peer lenders, it makes it much tougher because they're paying usury rates for places like that, even when they advertise those low rates. So can't the street, can't the free markets force rates higher?
Well, I mean, that's the hope for what we saw about the bond vigilantes, right? The bond markets could somehow force things higher because the vigilantes would refuse to accept that lower rate for what was sometimes clearly a sort of poorer credit quality. Unfortunately, you know, bear in mind that here you've got the most enormous amount of firepower coming at you from the side of policymakers, and it's pretty hard to keep up against that. Now, what I find fascinating is that I always look at it in terms of emotion. Now, if you look at volatility in the markets, if I was thinking about what it actually means, volatility is nothing more than competing opinions and pools of emotions in the market. And the fact of the matter is that as long as there's two strong competing pools of thought, you get volatility. If you end up in an environment as we have been for the last few years, where actually for all of the talk about tail risks and stuff, volatility has been extremely low. And in fact, the structure of volatility of the last few years has been one where volatility is ridiculously low, and then every now and then it spikes and then it goes back down again. What does that tell me? That tells me that most of the market, by and large, has accepted the view that you don't fight the policymakers, you stay with them. Every now and then there's a wobble where you kind of look behind the curtain, you get a bit worried because the emperor may not have any clothes on, and you suddenly start to think maybe the world is different. But then they quickly do something like turn on the monetary tap again, say some soothing words, promise a big course of action, and so you again decide, let's not fight the Fed or the government. Donald Trump is fundamentally a guy who made a lot of his money in real estate. He's a property developer. Property developers generally like low interest rates. And I can see that with the big infrastructure plan he's got, you know, what's interesting there is that, and the details are still sketchy, but he's not going to be issuing lots of debt to pay for it. But what he is going to do is hand out lots and lots of tax breaks. Now, who's going to fund this? Maybe pension plans, insurance companies, endowments, all these kind of people. And what most of them actually want is not so much equity return as much as contractual cash flow. I mean, let's not forget that CalPERS, for example, recently announced they're going to reduce the discount rate on their pension scheme down to, if I remember correctly, it was 7.5%, which is laughable, by the way, because CalPERS for the last 10 years has made about 3% a year on its investment. So the idea that they're somehow pretending that they're going to make 7.5% going forward tells you that they're living in some cuckoo land. CalPERS, in fact, is bankrupt.
Oh, I mean, California teachers, of course, they're cuckoo.
Yeah, but the whole thing is CalPERS is actually bankrupt. CalPERS is highly cash flow negative. It needs enormous contributions to bail it out to the extent that, frankly speaking, it never will get bailed out. That is also true, by the way, of endless other public pension schemes all over the place. So when I look at infrastructure spending and stuff, I can see the lobbying and the demand for what people want is not, by the way, a free market thing. It's going to be a case of, look, I've got this enormous debt I need to pay off over the next half century, and you are going to give me the contractual return I need to pay that off. So actually what you're doing at the moment is I see nothing that's forcing the liquidation, nothing that is forcing the creative destruction that a system needs in order to cleanse itself and start again. That only happens when people start to realize that certain corporates, systems, entities, etc. are bankrupt, that their balance sheet should, rather than being bailed out, should just be excised completely and started all over again.
Well, I mean, now, when we look at this whole thing, I mean, we have, I believe I read that the world debt GDP, debt to GDP is 325-1, or 325%. I mean, how are we ever going to get out of that without relieving debt? And how do they relieve it? And who sucks it down, except for, of course, the middle class, as usual?
Well, this is the problem. I mean, they're trying to do it the old-fashioned way, right? I mean, you know, simple stat is that if you look at global debt, in terms of the public debt markets, that has increased in size by 10 times over the last 25 years. GDP has not increased by a factor of 10, so therefore the leverage system has gone up enormously. In fact, what's even more scary is that you actually now have about 50-60% more debt today than you had in 2007. And since we all know the last crisis was caused by too much debt, you know, it wasn't subprime or anything, that was just the fact there was just too much debt in the system, the system couldn't cope. The idea that somehow now you've got 50-60% more and you think it's okay makes no sense. This is also why I'm convinced that ultra-loose policy, whether it's monetary or fiscal, doesn't run away anytime soon, because the moment they start to let rates rise, that little facade they've built up, you know, that wonderful kind of smoke and mirrors they've done to hide this huge amount of debt, starts to unravel, and people start to realize how bad the situation is. Now, they can try and get the middle class to pay. That's what they've tried to do by effectively taking on financial repression, where they suppressed wage growth, they suppressed, creating effectively inflation through the back door by just slowly writing down people's earnings and so on. But the problem is that people already are rebelling against that. And I think where you're heading towards, unfortunately, is a repeat of the 1920s, where ultimately, at some point, society says, you know what, this social contract we have, guys, isn't working. We're just going to rewrite the rules. And the guys who come in rewrite the rules. And they rewrite them badly. More often than not, they will. But they will rewrite them trying to fix a problem that nobody else is fixing. And so usually in that scenario, you tend to default catastrophically rather than find some more sensible way of doing it.
Well, yeah, I see a tremendous amount of default. I personally believe that the banking system, not one of them could pass a real stress test. That's my opinion. Again, I have no factual evidence behind that, but I would be willing to bet a lot of money that if we actually went and did an audit of all these banks, there would not be enough money to satisfy what's supposed to be their reserve. And I think that the entire system is totally screwed up and has to be evaluated and refixed. But the only way that that'll happen is if they let the system do as you say, flush it down the toilet and let the weak go, because this call for inflation, and I'm going to talk to this when we come back from the break, but this call for inflation is really only another way for the government to raise more money on my money, because they can charge me more taxes if they can get the prices to go higher. And that, to me, is another criminal sin. But we are with my man, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, also the author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, right out of jury duty and just getting over the flu. Man, he's a trooper. We got him going. This is, make sure you go to libertytalk.fm and download The Bubba Show every single day. We'll be right back after the break with more from Dr. Bob Swarup. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horvitz, are coming back. Welcome back to The Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horwitz with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panic, Spoons, and Busts, and 100 other things. One of the smartest guys I know. Okay, Dr. Bob, so I say the banks got nothing. I say that they're in trouble, and inflation is really what they call a hidden tax, because if they get me to pay more, it means my property taxes go up. It means my taxes at the stores go up. It means everything I have to pay tax on goes up because they got inflation, which means that once again, I'm financing the debt of some idiot who couldn't do their job right in the first place.
Well, I think this is also why I find it hard to see the reflation hypothesis working. Because, you know, again, I think that's people's dreams. At the end of the day, if you look at the anger that's out there in society globally, it's because you think you're not earning enough. You think that the world is getting a lot more expensive and you're getting a lot more debt on your balance sheet because you can't keep pace with what's going on. And I think, you know, if I look around, if you start to now produce inflation, and the UK, by the way, is already getting it because of the collapse in the pound, you know, that actually increases the stress levels enormously on families, because at the end of the day, guess what? Food and energy, always the two biggest costs for anybody out there that matter. And if you go and look at the Arab Spring, when the Arab Spring happened a few years ago, it was not a cry for democracy or freedom or whatever people might like to think. That's the aspirational dreaming bit. In reality, it was a cry against the rising price of energy and the rising price of food. And that's where the protests began, and that's where the revolutions happened. So if you put inflation into the system, I think you only end up making the populist problem far, far worse, not better. And I think the other problem also they have is that, since we've already discussed at length about how there is too much debt in the system, fundamentally, you have not had any deleveraging. Deleveraging, by definition, is deflationary. So what I see right now is this wonderful kind of immovable object, unstoppable force that's happening, where you've got all these things. We need to have inflation. We need to kind of go out there and build, whether it's dams and bridges, and throw more money at the problem. On the other side, you've got way too much debt in the system that needs to be written down. And unfortunately, if there's one thing I think history does teach you, is that inevitably, at the very end of it all, the debt mountain always wins, because it becomes too unsustainable and it does start to collapse. And when it does, that's your classic deflationary spiral.
And of course, that will be the end of what we have now. I mean, again, they always end the same way. It doesn't matter what bubble you look at. So now we've got, now that we come back across the pond, and of course we've got the inauguration of Donald Trump coming up, and we've got all of his plans now. Of course, the markets have basically skyrocketed since he got elected, and all on the promise and theory that he's going to lift the regulations on the banks and, you know, lower taxes. And I go, that's great, and I hope he does it. Believe me, it would be good for everybody. However, the markets have gotten significantly in front of themselves here, because earnings that we're starting now certainly are not going to be able to match what he's talking about. So how far can the market be carried waiting that he might get these things through? Might, because, again, you know that even though the Congress and Senate are both Republican, if it's going to cost them votes, they're not voting for it. And then tie into the fact that the Social Security, kind of going back to CalPERS, they're paying out $100 billion a year more than they're taking in. So that's a bankrupt system, and then you throw in Medicare. So how does all this end up working out going forward, even if he can get all these things done? Because he's at least, what would you say, a year away before he can get it all in place anyways, so we don't get the 4% growth that they're promising. If you get it at all, you ain't getting it for a couple of years. So how does that all work out?
Well, I think, you know, the problem is that if you're a president coming in, you realistically only really have 2 years anyway, because within 2 years, you're basically preparing for the next lot of primaries and re-election. So, you know, whatever you've got to get done, you've got to get done now. Your point about the houses, I think, is important. The Republicans were not big fans of Donald Trump coming in. And the fact that, you know, right now they're all on the same page is more a marriage of convenience than anything else. So if you look at what their priorities are, they've become obsessed with repealing Obamacare. They want to kind of push through all the big projects that they had in their minds for the last, you know, near decade. And that's what the agenda is. So I think to a large extent, you're going to find actually increasing conflict between sort of Donald Trump and the sort of houses, simply because they're going to be moving not necessarily in the same direction. I think the other problem is that regardless of what policies they push through, regardless of how well-intentioned and even how perfectly they're executed, I think the some of the problems you've pointed out, like the fact that they basically are running a bankrupt system, the fact that, by the way, we're not talking about fixing an economy back in the 1970s when, yeah, sure, debt was high, but not that bad, and you still had storehouses of wealth somewhere that you could utilize. Here you're talking about a system that is truly bankrupt, where you're kind of asking it to somehow look down the back of the sofa and find that little bit more to keep it going. And I really don't see how that happens easily. I mean, you have a situation where it's very hard for them to unwind the Social Security stuff. I mean, forget about Obamacare, which had its own issues, but just Social Security in general, the cost of that is rising rapidly and will continue to do so, if nothing else, because the U.S. population is aging rapidly. And that aging rapidly demographic, by the way, is not the... is actually a white demographic largely, because they're the ones who have the lowest replacement ratios. I mean, you know, in this country, for example, in the UK, when the Conservative Party got into power a few years ago, they were the ones who pushed through a guarantee on the state pension, which guaranteed that forevermore, the state pension would always go out by the minimum of inflation, wage inflation, or 2.5%. Whatever of the highest of those three were, that's what the state pension would go up by. And you know, the fact that you had a conservative government that was pushing through this measure was remarkable. The reason they did it was because they knew exactly who their voters were, and they did not want to do anything to break that relationship. But of course, all they were really doing what every politician did, which was just to make the problem worse, but quickly sweep it on the carpet, because you know it won't come back to haunt you in this parliament.
Right. No, I mean, that, that is one of the biggest problems. The problem is when you're appealing only to the voter, you're not going to get. That's why guys won't change, you know, Social Security. I mean, Social Security, the age should have been moved many, many years ago, but it should be 80 right now for Social Security, because the average living age is about 77. So, you know, at 80, you're now in a spot where a lot of people will die off, so not everybody has to get paid. Okay, and that was. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, I can tell you, it used to be a lot worse when they introduced the first ever state pension system. That was actually the Germans, Bismarck, back in the 19th century. And he introduced Social Security beginning at age 70 at a time when the average German life expectancy was 48.
Yeah, there you go. So they had plenty of money. They didn't have that problem that we can have, right? I mean, well, think about it. You know what's really sad about it, Dr. Bob, is that if people could save themselves, which we know they can't, which is why the Social Security was a good idea, but if they could save themselves, I mean, if you put that money away, you know, I paid the maximum every year since 1970, okay? And I'll, you know, fortunately, I'm close because I'm going at 62 for my Social Security. I'm not missing a dime. But at the end of the day, it's a backwards plan. But again, it's the same as they continue to kick the can down the street, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that is really that's the real problem in everything that we do in all these pension funds, because they just don't fund them properly. If they'd leave them alone, they would be fine. And you got 30 seconds. Yeah. Sum it up for me.
Well, listen, I think we're in for a roller coaster for a year. I think everyone's going to be very, very euphoric, but I think they're going to find they've got a pretty bad hangover, especially as we head in the second half of the year.
So, in other words, it won't be it'll be a happy new year right now, but when it's all said and done, you're going to need a lot of Excedrin to get it through. This has been my guy, Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of Money Mania, Panic Systems, and Bust. Thanks, Dr. Bob. I appreciate it.
Great book.
Hey, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, and this is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Make sure when you miss an episode, you go to LibertyTalk.fm and download the show every single day, as well as The Sporting Edge on the weekends, now being run by Xander and Roz. In the meantime, go to BubbaTrading.com as well, and everybody have a great and wonderful day. Always appreciate you being here. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. Have a good day, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll see you later.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.